Three, two, one, let's begin. Hello, barbarians, and welcome to the 38th episode of the LLB podcast. Today, with us, Jangan from Singapore and June from KL. Okay, so for the first topic, shall we begin? Jangan wanted to talk with Taylor Swift. I don't know if we are, if anyone wants to hear about...
No, I want to... About Taylor Swift, not with Taylor
Swift. About with Taylor Swift, because I think, well, for Jangan, his life is directly affected by it. And to some degree, people in KL as well, because there's some spillage of people flying in from KL first, maybe staying in JB, then going to Singapore to see Taylor Swift. Basically, she shut... I don't know how true it is, but how bad is it, Jangan? Did she shut down the whole city? Is it a mess? I saw a lot of crazy things, like hotel prices, like were 5x the price of, you know, usual prices. Is it possible to get around, or what's it like down there?
So almost like a week. I mean, today's Sunday, right? Yesterday was the first concert. I think altogether there are six. What happened a week before the concert is that, I'm driving in Singapore, and all across the expressways, it gives a warning that, okay, from this day to this date, avoid a stadium area where the concert is held. I expect delays there. Mm-hmm. So it seems that there's lots of... lots of traffic and lots of people expected. The first concert yesterday, I think 60,000 people attended, and many of them flying from all over Asia. I'm not directly affected because I've been sleeping the whole day yesterday. The week has been hectic, but it's all around you, right? You see people on social media talking about. I mean, they're either at a concert or at home listening to the songs and complaining that, okay, why do we have to go to the concert? And the people who are at home are usually like older male, and the people who are going there are usually younger female. Yeah. And we had a colleague flying from Hanoi this week, and noticeably the flight ticket was actually more expensive than what it usually is.
Yeah, I think if you don't book far in advance for this, I know that there were some people who didn't really old people who didn't realize that the concert was going on, and so they just happened to coincidentally go to Singapore, and they were very confused of why everything was so expensive. But anyway, yeah, what were we saying? We're saying, like, I think woke culture is not really a good association to her, but interesting enough, I think in her early career, she was very much driven by, you know, building machine and, you know, playing along with the politics. And so she never really spoke her mind, which I think later on she came out in interviews that she really wanted to, you know, but then now that she's kind of made her, I don't know, she's what, like a billionaire? Now she's probably not afraid to speak her mind. She's more political, which is more interesting. I wouldn't say that's really woke, but she's just more like taking a stance, which I think is interesting. Before, people were criticizing her for not having opinions, for being too... Just pleasing everyone like a diplomat, right? So, but I think things have changed for her. And then the impact is crazy, though. I think what's more interesting is that my sister was telling me that all the places she goes in the U.S. to eat, like, those businesses get destroyed because the people always just want to eat there wherever she goes to eat, and the business can't cope, and then they end up shutting down. So I'm kind of curious to see what happens in Singapore if she goes around Singapore to see where she's going to eat and what's going to happen. What do you think?
I don't know. I mean, if it's an Asian business that she goes to, and the boss surely is able to find like neighbors, you know, people in the same industry to help him expand the capacity very quickly. That's what happens to production in China and Vietnam, right? So I don't understand the concept of a business can't cope with increased volume and then shut down.
It's like if it's a small mom and pop shop. Well, I mean, I guess like it's equivalent to the guy who got the Michelin star, the chicken rice guy in Singapore. He just kind of sold out, which is fair. You know, he made his money. Mm. But then, like, just, you know, he made a bunch of change and the quality dropped and he lost his star, right? So I guess, like, it can, like, you always find a partner to scale, but then at what cost, right? You know, it could be really good food. Mm. But then, you know, then it's just, she comes and destroys everything, you know, like a tornado. I don't know.
Is your sister a fan or not?
No, she's not. She has very specific curated music taste. You know, so she's like a different generation. Okay. She's not really a Swiftie. The only Swiftie we really know, and he probably should be here, is Dave Chang. Like, he's like a big Swiftie head, apparently. And so I don't know how that...
Dave Chang's like, he's like 4 or 5 years older than Taylor Swift. So he can still find it like resonating.
Yeah. My sister's same age as Dave, though. You know, so it's just like kind of diverging.
Your elder sister.
Yeah, my elder sister. I mean, you're also not that far off than Dave, right? You're like maybe a year older only. You don't, are you a Swiftie?
I'm not, but I mean, I generally have not had any like emotional connection with any of the pop stars throughout my life. But about, I think 60% of my office is.
Okay, interesting. What generation are they?
Mostly people born, I think people in my office who are associated with her are mostly born between 1992 and 1999.
Okay, like old, young millennials, right? I guess like the generation closer to a Gen Z, I guess, but still millennial.
Young millennial and a bit of like the earlier part of Gen Z. And so I remember last year when they were selling the tickets for Taylor Swift tour in Asia. Singapore and Japan, right? I mean, many of them actually were spending time having multiple computers like connected to basically try to secure a ticket, and you do see that people are sort of trying to buy tickets for each other. Yeah. So that, I mean, so basically have multiple computers at multiple people's houses who are trying to secure a ticket, and they have made this agreement that okay, if I get multiple tickets, there'll be one or a few for you.
Yeah,
I think it has become a movement, right? So, and of course, most of the male colleagues, I mean, I don't have many male colleagues, but most of them do not understand why this is going on.
Are they older or same generation?
And even if they're of the same generation, they are actually, yeah, don't quite get it. I mean, they know that she's popular, but they don't see the emotional connection. But I think June said it's the last American icon. I don't know. I can never make that assessment. But over the past few years, I've talked to people, young people in office specifically, about why do they like Taylor Swift so much, and most of them are telling me that they feel this strong emotional connection. Right. I mean, the sort of over the last 10, 15 years, and every stage of life. I mean, she sings, and the lyrics really, really appeal to them emotionally.
Yeah, I mean, I think she's very much just a product of the machine, though. And I mean, I had this conversation earlier with my sister because she's visiting in KL, and her initial hypothesis and theory around music and your connection to it was like, she thought it was when you form, like, you know, like for her, it was like in the 20s. And so she thought it was something very tied to that like transformation of becoming an adult. But then we talked around to other people, and it just, a lot of people actually even younger had stronger emotional connections. Like Sabrina had a connection when growing up listening to her father's music. So she feels emotionally connected to like really, really oldies music. For me, I still, she didn't feel strong. My sister didn't feel strongly connected to high school, but then I had some bands that I was connected to when I was in high school. So it's, I think it's, I don't know. What is your take on like, how people form the connection with music, and then what do you think it more broadly means, like the whole Taylor Swift trend? Is it just like a globalization trend? Is it just like we're homogenizing culture? Is it, I don't know, do you think it's a good thing or a bad thing?
I think overall, I mean, everything happens for a reason. And personally, I think it's a good thing to a certain extent. And you see like lots of young people, they have kind of purpose. They have a sense of belonging. They have a community. So this morning I was flipping through the media reports and social media in Singapore.
Yeah.
And what has been accentuated is young people at the Taylor Swift concert, right? Yeah. And they are exchanging these bracelets, right? I mean, and many of them having like, no, I don't know, 30, 40, 50 bracelets on their wrists. So they really, really feel a sense of belonging. And in a way, I don't know. I mean, the way I look at it, it feels a kind of cult to me. But of course, I mean, a cult is formed by different reasons. Some of them more sort of well-intentioned. Some of them more malicious. But this seems to be a cult being formed, and people feeling strong emotional connections. Yeah, I mean.
Cult of Taylor Swift.
Yeah, you go to TikTok, you search for those videos of people,
yeah, they go crazy.
From different countries on a film, yeah, from different countries, like, you know, sitting in front of a computer trying to get a ticket, and the emotional output output that they express once they have secured a ticket. Not even at the scene itself, yeah,
you know,
buying the ticket.
You know, I think this is a very interesting conversation because it sits at the intersection of kind of like our, the kind of content we make around business and tech people, but it sits at the intersection of culture, right? And so I think I hypothesize that this is by and large driven by the algorithms that the US social media companies have invented. And it's a question of like, do you think this type of algorithms that drive this behavior and this, as you say, you know, potentially like this cult-like behavior, what does that say about us as, you know, humans and species? And like, how do you think about tech evolves further from this? And is this a good thing culturally or a bad thing? I think it's kind of weird. I mean, I don't know. I really don't know.
I think, did you hear the siren in my background?
No, I can't hear it. You're good.
Okay. That's, what's the siren background? I do think that the social media certainly amplifies that because that allows that really allows a community to form, right? I mean, in the past you had broadcast media and popular songs would go across the globe,
yeah.
But for the fans to connect with each other to form a community, in the past you pretty much have to rely on offline events,
yeah.
And nowadays I think there are much more ways for people to connect with each other and. I would think that, Taylor Swift, whether it's herself or whether it's the team around her, they are certainly very good at leveraging all these tools available to them. I've read a thesis saying that somebody did analysis about the people around her and they're very, very good qualified professionals doing whatever they do. And the article made an interesting argument saying that it's because these people are Swift fans themselves, are Swifty themselves.
Yeah, for sure.
And they feel emotionally connected to that. And,
it's almost like religion,
and that,
like you said.
And that whole, that whole phenomenon helps them attract the really best talent to work for them and to do whatever they want. I'm not sure whether the same can be said about Trump.
Yeah. Well, I think you're right. From a branding, from a branding and business perspective, that's like, it's fantastic.
Whether it's good like socially or not, right?
Okay, yeah. What I wanted to say earlier, like, so you kept bringing this up. I think you're right. Like, there is this. Maybe it's a generational thing because the younger generations below us as millennials are lost in this social media landscape and grasp for meaning, right? And there are many ways that they have access to so much stuff. Like the internet, like they could access any generation they want and connect to it. And I have a hunch that. We're at a point in time where we're looking more backwards versus looking forwards. You look at the fashion trends, a lot of the music tastes, a lot of things, right? And I think that, you know, maybe June's comment about this being the last cultural export is more tied to a comment on capitalism, right? I think Taylor Swift is just a beautiful manifestation of capitalism. Like this is the wet dream, right? Like it just makes so much money. The branding's so strong. The business is good. But like what I want to tie it to is like this community that is allowed to form with new technology behind this idea of Taylor Swift, like what ends? Like what are you connecting with? Just the idea of Taylor Swift, right? It's not rooted deeper than that. But it's just to me, it's tied back to the machine that created it and people are feeling lost in this generation. And so they're just connecting through that emptiness, which is kind of weird, I think. I don't know.
The notion about people feeling lost. Did you feel lost when you were a kid? See, like back in like early 1990s?
That's why I think it was different. Like 80s, 90s almost was a counterculture and a golden type era, right? It was like, you know, indefinite optimism. Like we could do anything. And it was like, if everything felt great, you know, it was like a really good time. Whereas now you're growing up, you know, behind an iPad and a screen and you're just looking, you're flipping through that. You're addicted to it. You know, you're looking for meaning, but it felt different growing up, you know, like we played outside and it was just a very different time, I think. It was a lot of culture was born out of this counterculture of our older generations. Maybe I'm just very old and this is the same trend happening. Like it's a rejection of what I thought was golden age, but it just seems like technology has done something and the tech bros and the finance bros behind the tech bros, like there's some accountability here that, you know, it's like, we've pushed our society to where it is. It's more globalized through online and media. Like you said, it allows for connection, right? Which is good because people may feel that being lost. Maybe my interpretation is wrong though. I don't know. Maybe there's more substance and I'm just too old and I'm not connected to it, you know?
I think when we were kids, first we're not subject to so much sort of glamorous messages on social media. What do you see on TV that you feel is distant from you? It is distant from you. On social media, everybody expresses the best part of that. Everybody leaves like the melancholic, the sad part of that outside in private. So I'm not sure how much that gap has been accentuated by all these manifestations of social media, but I certainly like appreciate the days where you could actually go out and play, right? I mean, you don't have to so much like a constant distraction on social media and stuff. And you listen to the music from the loudspeaker.
You know what my sister told me? Sister was telling me that they're actually like, because she follows a lot of like niche culture, because she's actually not plugged into any of this. Mm. She's like off in her own world doing ceramics and like into very eclectic kind of stuff. And then she was telling me that there's this kind of mall revival in the US, but it's because the younger generation actually want to meet up. They like need somewhere to go, right? Right now it's like very wild and rabid where, I don't know, like youth is just, youth has turned social media, like social media has turned youth into like, they need an outlet. But there's like, now there's like, they want to meet at malls. The malls are kind of getting revived. So it's kind of interesting. You know, like there's this whole kind of like what the 80s and 90s for us maybe were, because we would also hang out in malls and stuff, at least in the US. I can't say outside US, but this is what my sister was telling me, within US. So it'd be interesting to see if we, you know, when we travel around and talk around, maybe we could find other people to see what the youth feels like too. So, but yeah, I think, especially with COVID, people want to meet, you know?
And also there's a bigger challenge here is that we can talk to people. We can try to be as open as we are and to try to figure out sort of what they tell us, how they feel and stuff.
Yeah.
But this is something I felt very strongly when I was back this time around to China for the Lunar New Year. Mm. I mean, you feel that you talk to your parents, you talk to your uncles, you talk to your grandparents. I mean, it's all very nice, right? They welcome you. You talk about old stories and, you know, I mean, you may talk to your cousins, but your experience is different from theirs at a personal level and maybe at a collective level as well. So you don't actually know what they were really thinking. You don't know what's deep in their mind. I mean, the same for us when we talk to millennials. It takes a while to actually get to know like how the people are really thinking. I mean, think about all those companies all those corporates which try to appeal to millennials. I mean, how many of them actually get it right?
Yeah.
Even if they do all the market research, they speak to all the people, they do all the surveys and stuff.
Mm.
It's But then that probably goes back to the point of this emotional connection, right? What Taylor Swift is able to draw, because when people feel that emotional connection and the way that you can conduct the business on top of that, it's much more different versus that you try to understand a person from a different demographic and then try to create a product for them.
Yeah, you know, I'd be very interested to see the evolution of that machine. Because, I mean, it's very rooted in very traditional things, like typical record label, big star power, you know, touring concert. The business model is quite clear. But I think going from like 100 million to a billion, right, like in terms of her net worth, there is something different probably behind that. Like, or she's, maybe it could just be good timing. You know, like, it was just like she was a very good enough, you know, medium for, and no, not, she was not too specific where everyone could see herself in her, kind of like the Twilight series, right? And it was just good timing, and maybe she's just riding the wave, who knows, you know.
Somebody in my office who was born in 1995 told me that so she felt this strong connection with Taylor Swift, like can't remember which year, but a long time ago, and she was telling me that you know, for lots of singers, right, they have this prime period, like a few years where they can, you know, have all the hits and stuff. But afterwards, they drop out. They started talking about things which do not resonate with their core audience anymore. And maybe because they become so rich, maybe because they're having different feelings, etc. But what she told me is that, at least for the last 10 years or so, I think Taylor Swift has been fairly consistently emotionally appealing to them.
So that's a good question. Is it a question of character or is she a better businesswoman? Right, like she's so focused and so disciplined that she keeps building her brand and empire, or is she like, you know, fundamentally she's just like that and consistent and resonates very well in a broad audience? I'd be very curious to kind of.
I think fundamentally you have to like it to make it do so well, right? I mean, you are not like a financier behind the scene, and it's you, it's the image, right? I mean, if you don't like the image you are portraying to the whole world, I mean, like some of the Korean pop groups, right? I mean, you see so many suicides in Korean sort of pop stars. I mean, people sort of force themselves into this image, which might not necessarily resonate with them. But I don't know. I think it appears to me that whatever Taylor Swift is exhibiting is probably natural for her.
You think so? Maybe she's just a psychopath businesswoman and she's just really good at it. I don't know, man. I mean, I don't follow this. So.
I don't know. I mean,
it's just really fascinating, though.
There's a there's another subtopic related to that is you heard about recently that some of the governments in the region are complaining that Singapore is paying the organizer of the concert for this to be held exclusively in Singapore in Southeast Asia.
Yeah, what's wrong with that?
And someone was complaining. Somebody from the Philippines, was, some politician in the Philippines was complaining. I think somebody from, I think the prime minister was of Thailand was complaining as well.
Well, let them complain. Mm. I mean, that's like, you know, improve your own country then if you want that, right?
This to me is fascinating. I mean, the prime minister of Thailand was saying that Singapore is paying like $3 million per concert for six.
Sounds pretty cheap,
and
right?
The Singapore government had, so the Singapore government had to come out and defend, saying that okay, yeah, we paid some money to make it exclusive, but it's way below that. Probably it's true that it's way below that, but but one thing that that is impressive is that the government of Singapore actually formed a task force a long time ago when they learned about this concert was going to take place, and they started engaged with the organizer. Very early on, and they did lots of planning, and they did lots of sort of internal justification of why they are using taxpayers' money. They did modeling and stuff.
I think this is still fantastic for the Singapore branding. No, they are already by default, just by how Singapore is the default place to go. Because we saw the debacle of 1975 coming to Malaysia, right? I mean, that was just like a huge disaster. It just pissed off every single local here. And then because of that, the Strokes also had to cancel their whole Asia tour as well, right? It's just like,
Now, what happened?
Well, the 1975 thing where the lead band singer from 1975, like he's well known for doing this. He goes to countries and stirs up shit. But he basically called out Malaysia for being anti-LGBT. And then like he kissed his bandmate in front of everyone. And then he got banned from Malaysia. And then there was this huge backlash where a lot of famous artists were supposed to come through Malaysia. They all like canceled their tours. This is a big, you know, this just supports more reason why people go to Singapore, right? It's just like it's not helping. It's stupid. Like if you really want to make like if you really disagree with a country, just don't come in the first place, right? Just there's no need to like piss off all the locals. And you know, apparently like I can't speak for the locals, but the people who were affected said like it put things far behind. It made their life worse because of that incident. You know, it's just very egotistical from these artists. But I mean, that's just like the context. So,
I think one thing Singapore has branded itself is that traditionally as a strong pro business destination, and also even amongst the local population, it tries to get the debate about religion about everything. To be sort of not talked about in a way, so people can't really debate or say bad things about others, even though whether it's justified or not. So I think that came from a practical consideration, right? Because it's a multiracial society, and you need to keep it harmonious so that businesses will come. But over the years, it has built this system, right? I mean, what is sort of recognized, what is not recognized, and the thing is that the rule is clear. The rule is clear. Mm. The rule is consistent. The rule is enforced, right? I mean, if somebody like talks bad things about Singapore's policy, the government actually sends a person. Sometimes like ex-lawyer who happens to be government minister and who is very good at debate, and they want to debate about things, which is good because it puts puts the things in the public and it avoids all this like, you know, backlash and stuff.
Yeah, there's I remember there was a recently big brouhaha in Singapore about some semi-influencer who was like seeing something or doing like making content about Gaza and then it got clamped down. I mean, I know it was past my headlines really quickly, but I think I remember that was just like, it was something where people were like, oh, like, you know, you're clamping down on free speech, but then this person could be seen as stirring, you know, like you said, mm-hmm. going against those like no-go areas that you can't talk about. So
pros and cons, I guess. There has been a few sort of ministerial speeches recently talking about sort of the Gaza situation because a part of the population resonate with, I think probably a fairly significant part of the society resonates with what the people are suffering in Gaza, right? I mean, even as like, you know, people who don't have an emotional connection to Gaza, so Gazans, where you look at all these images, you feel like, okay, something's not justified. But I think was the minister this week or last week who came on and said that, okay, there has been calls in a society for us to cut off the relationship with Israel. But I mean, how does that solve the problem? If we cut off the...
that's the whole sad part, right? Like, even if you can express yourself, it's not like really changing the situation, right? It's kind of, all of it's just depressing, you know, all around. So... It's tough.
Yeah, it kind of make yourself feel better, but it doesn't really change anything. It doesn't really change anything.
Correct.
So,
all right, sorry, go ahead.
Just one last point. I might have talked to you about that. I mean, right next to my house, they are building a Russian Orthodox church with the Russian Culture Center.
Oh, interesting.
And when the Ukraine war happened, and some people in the society in Singapore were calling the government saying that, it's not appropriate to do that when Russia is invading Ukraine. And I think there was a response from the government saying that, we have done sanctions towards Russia because of the violation of its neighbor's sovereignty, but I have nothing against Russian culture and Russian people, which is probably a good thing to say.
Yeah. I mean, it's separating people and their culture and religion versus what the government's doing, right? It's like the very common trope that everyone talks about. I think that makes sense. It makes perfect sense. Themselves, I guess. I mean, in Singapore, it's very, you know, life's kind of good and calm, so they got to, you know, fight. So they're very much like in Sun Valley, you know, there's too much excess of... you know, time and leisure, money. So these things happen, I guess.
There's also one thing which I think has been delivered consistently by the government throughout the pandemic. So they've basically been telling people, saying that, look, Singapore was aviation and the global transportation hub before the pandemic, and there's no guarantee that will still be so after the pandemic, because lots of things have been shaken up, and lots of flights have been canceled. Some of the routes are still not there. And if we do not actively work towards that, we might not remain the global aviation hub. So we need to work very hard towards maintaining that status. And that means bringing the people to Singapore. I think the whole Taylor Swift concert thing is part of that as well. That again sort of manifests Singapore's connectivity and hub status.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot going into this. I think in the future, maybe we should look for like this type of population type expert, because all those headlines, like every country hit a new record low, from Singapore, Korea, Japan, like everyone. And I think that feeds into the same kind of narrative, like your culture is going to change, people are going to change, what are you going to do about it? And we've talked about it in the past. But anyway, I think we have to move on, because we're getting cut on time. We both were in the corner of Southeast Asia, right next to or to each other. You were in Cambodia. I was in Vietnam. I would love to talk about what's going on in these countries. I can talk from a cultural standpoint and I guess previous history standpoint of living and working in Vietnam compared to what I see now. But, you know, I think even less people know about what's going on in Cambodia. So, I mean, what were you doing in Cambodia? What's going on? What's it like?
Okay, I was invited to speak at this Internet Startup Association of Cambodia's like annual gathering.
Nice.
And I was expecting, internet industry in Cambodia, like that's like, I don't know, a dozen of companies, maybe it's like a small room, like 30 people. And when I went there, I said, shit, this is a big hall, like 100 plus people there. And apparently there's so many different companies there. I mean, there are like a bunch of payment companies, five food delivery platforms, and some gaming companies. Five food delivery platforms and a bunch of neo banks, or sort of, I mean, whatever kind of constructed as offering banking services. And there's one guy who really impressed me, is that He's just firmly believed that Cambodia should be the financial center of Southeast Asia because Cambodia uses US dollar and there's no sort of restriction of capital flowing in and flowing out. And the government is, I mean, the governor of the central bank, et cetera, they're all like Western educated and they're very good at the sort of pushing the right policies and solving the newest problems and making things happen for the industry. I mean, it takes the time, but he firmly believes that Cambodia should be the financial center of Southeast Asia.
Which
I've never heard. I've never heard anybody around me talking about it. But
that's wildly contrarian. Wildly contrarian. I mean, it's an interesting idea. The thing that they would have to solve is number one, rule of law. Outside of that, though, if you could build like rails on blockchain, maybe that would be possible, right? If their systems plug into blockchain, it becomes immutable. Trust is the main issue, right? You know, maybe they can pioneer that. Who knows? But yeah, that's very contrarian. I'd be kind of curious to follow up with this to see what is he doing? Is he building in fintech or what is he doing?
He's building a securities firm and also he has launched multiple schemes for Cambodian companies to try to list in a Cambodian exchange. And he's trying to facilitate international investors to put money into the Cambodian exchange. I mean, it's tough. So
wild.
I know I've seen his photos, right? Yeah, I mean, like over like 2-3 years, and he has visibly become much older. And that's probably all the hard work that he has been trying to put.
Yeah. So what's the vibe then? Is the way you describe the ecosystem, is it like we're looking back at like 10, 20 years of what we saw in the rest of Southeast Asian countries? Is it lagging or is this like a new paradigm? Is it its own ecosystem? Because it sounds similar to like we started building e-commerce and food delivery in Southeast Asia like more than 10 years ago. So what do you think?
I think first, Cambodia is a place where large regional platforms or regional international investors do not have attention to at all, right? I mean, 16 million people, that's half of Malaysia and half of Jakarta.
16, I thought it was 16. I thought it was 6 million. Oh my God, 16.
16. I mean, it's still small. GDP per capita is 1,600. So, which is like almost half of Vietnam's level, right? So it's actually relatively poor country. And apparently, I was there for just a day and a half, but I visited like 5 or 6 different businesses. I spoke with different associations as well, in addition to the dinner I was attending. And how would I say? I learned a lot about how things function, right? I mean, so there are lots of banks, I mean, trying out different kinds of fintech. And because the market is relatively small, because you don't have that much sort of incumbent large structure, which is already like their legacy. So there's lots of innovation going on. And also you paradoxically that, I mean, partially you feel that like it's China because like almost all businesses would have Chinese signs and almost everybody spoke to in Phnom Penh, the service staff, the immigration officers, custom officers, airline check-in, I mean, hotel reception, everybody speaks Mandarin to you or tries to speak Mandarin to you.
Really? Interesting. But this is just proxy because they're neighbors to China and they must get so much flow from China investment-wise, government-wise. I mean, I don't know about tourism. Tourism probably not, right?
Not much tourism, but business. There's lots of Chinese business set up
business,
there.
Right?
I was speaking to people from my hometown. Even they told us that they know like 3 or 4 manufacturing businesses which have built large centers in Cambodia. So there's lots of business going on there. And interestingly, people told me that they leverage a lot on the port of Ho Chi Minh because it's just close.
In the sense of what, for the manufacturing for trade, like going to China or abroad.
Going broad, so if you think about Phnom Penh, it's like two hours to the port of Ho Chi Minh, and about an hour and close to 2 hours to the port of Sihanoukville. So it's about the same traveling time, but the port of Ho Chi Minh is obviously much bigger, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, it's It's an interesting standalone ecosystem, and everybody's telling me that, of course, from a manufacturing and a real business point of view, they feel very connected to China. From an internet point of view, they feel left out. So nobody cares about them. They're trying to figure out things on their own. Nobody actually visits. So in fact, they were very happy I was there. So
I think that's very interesting in terms of like a cultural a. I don't know, soft and hard power export of China, right? They can export the hard stuff, but then the way that like internet is set up so insularly in China is that it's very hard for foreigners to be part of that kind of ecosystem, right? Like you really have to be Chinese to benefit from the Chinese kind of internet, right? So it's kind of interesting what you described is that they can take the manufacturing and I guess it's spillover right next door. China, the gold come down, the bizarre thing there. So they, in one sense, they're very fortunate, but they kind of have to develop their own kind of internet culture, which is interesting because, yeah, I guess the rest of Southeast Asia, you always forget about Laos, you always forget about Cambodia.
Mm-mm-mm.
I mean, I don't think we should even mention Timor Leste, right? So,
and another thing is that I was asking people why do people use U.S. dollars and of course this is not the official explanation. This is what a few people told me, right? They said after the war, and the war only ended like 1990s, 1995, 1997.
Yeah.
When the Khmer Rouge, I mean, finally surrendered from their like forest hideouts.
Officially, okay.
Yeah. When the war ended, there were lots of aid organizations which went to Cambodia. Even to today, there are like thousands of NGOs and or sort of international, intergovernmental organizations which are doing different kinds of humanitarian work in Cambodia, like empowering the villagers, helping people with a specific kind of surgeries, and also demining is still a big operation going on there. So that caused an influx of people from outside, and many of them carry U.S. dollars with them. So that kind of made the U.S. dollars still widely accepted to a certain extent. Then the government just pegged and it allowed U.S. dollar to circulate. I mean, the few places we were in,
interesting,
in Phnom Penh, I think I didn't touch local currency at all. That's like everything I was I was paying with USD. Yeah.
That was like 20 years ago in Vietnam or something like that. That's crazy. It's such an interesting that this kind of like ecosystem can still exist today. You know, you think that Southeast Asia has progressed far, far ahead of that, but you know, developed their own economy and infrastructure. Do you think that, so what's the trajectory like to close out for this section on Cambodia, the trajectories and or what's your like main takeaways?
That kind of, you know, last year I had a session with Jim Rogers, the famous investor based out of Singapore. Mm-hmm. And one thing he mentioned during that session, which I didn't pay much attention to, and was, he said, so where do we look for bright spots in Southeast Asia or in Asia in general? And then he said, I think the Cambodian government is doing all the right things, but the market is too small. So you make your own judgment, right? And do you want to pay attention to that market? But he thinks the government is doing all the right things. And that's kind of feeling I got by talking to the businesses there. I mean, the government is very progressive. You know, there's a recent succession, and Hansen passes the premiership to his son, Hamanet.
Yeah.
This guy is Western educated. I think one person I talked to knows his wife really well, and he said they are actually quite progressive in the sense of, I mean, you look at policy in the country, how to make the country forward, not kind of like super left progressive. Okay.
Like grow your company.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. I think we'll have to revisit this topic. I'm interested more because I know one of my family friends had run some type of fertilizer business there for more than a decade, and he recently exited the market saying it was harder to operate there. So I'd like to probably revisit that idea to see, to contrast, you know, like what's progressive and what's being a foreigner there's, you know, getting squeezed out, but maybe it's good for locals. I don't know.
Just a quick point. So some people talk to me saying that the rule of law is still a problem, and they acknowledge that because there are still local interests who don't abide by the rule of law, and this usually happens with property businesses, and there's lots of lots of illegal seizure and stuff. But they said recently, I think the government has a clampdown on sort of people aligned with senior officials to try to seize assets which have any kind of international link, because from a central government or Cambodia point of view, they care a lot about their international reputation. And recently there has also been a crackdown on scam centers. But the thing is that the crackdown actually made scam centers more violent, because they said before it was free exchange, they had no problem hiring people. You know, there was no risk hiring people, and it was kind of legal, so it was fine. But now it's illegal, so they had to, you know, find ways to find workers, and sometimes can be a bit violent. So I mean, give and take.
That's one of the second order effects you don't realize, and if you don't fully clean it up or don't have strong enough rule of law to fully stamp it out, like I guess you could say like the gangs in Southeast Asia, right? Like sort of support government, just all of them. So you got to really, really go deep, I guess, to root out it all. But
fascinating topic.
It's a fascinating topic for sure. I mean, there are just parts of Southeast Asia we don't know about. I like that, you know, the contrarian take from Rogers. There's something there for sure, probably. And, you know, while a country can be small, it still has outsized impact, like we saw with Taylor Swift in Singapore, right? Singapore really can't grow consumer-wise big as some countries, but they still have other ways to get competitive advantages. So maybe Cambodia has that potential level in the future, right? You can get things under control, right? So it's interesting. I guess for the last topic for me, I just really my time in Vietnam. You know, I went in Ho Chi Minh for 4 days, just purely consumption, vacation, taking a stir, ate me too much. But, you know, it's just nice being in a bigger, well, price bigger. I don't know about, like, you know, consumer-wise bigger or, you know, bigger, but it's just bigger market by feeling, and it feels like very vibrant. You know, it's things have really bounced back fully, like from COVID. I mean, business wise, maybe not from a consumer viewing perspective. It seems like everything's very hustling, bustling. Like when I was still living there, you know, things are back. It seems to be things are improving too. Like you see a lot more electric cars on the road. VinFast is everywhere. People don't throw food on the ground anymore after eating. Like things are progressing. Things are like, I think the government is clamping down. Like after a certain hour, you see police on a lot of corners chasing down drunk drivers, but of course people say it's for money, but I mean at the same time it's still doing the job, right? Making people more at least following the law more, whether it's for good or bad, but trying to produce that behavior in society. So I don't know, I felt like Vietnam was really moving ahead, and it's feels like one of those countries that's going to be able to keep progressing forward at a faster rate relative to the rest of the Southeast Asian countries, because it's not as big as Indonesia, but it's definitely not a small country either, right? So
I'm kind of optimistic about Vietnam when you have a large population who are decently educated, who are hardworking. I mean, so that usually creates wonders. So last year, when you talk about Vietnam, I mean, especially the first half of last year, you hear all the bad news, right? You hear about, like, you know, property market not sustaining. I mean, the bubble collapsing. You talk about, export being impacted. I've seen notices of multiple sort of manufacturing businesses laying off like thousands of people. So when that kind of narratives come together, people are saying, oh, is the economy collapsing? But quite often, I mean, when it just creates incentive for others to come in and sort of build things, right? Because the fundamentals are still there. I mean, you have the labor, you have the hardworking people, you have the infrastructure that has been built. Oh yeah, last year there was also this talk about, you know, there's not enough electricity in Hanoi. There was blackouts in summer, if you remember. But many of these, right, when things happen, it creates incentives for people to solve the problems. I mean, if people are hardworking, if the macro is not like, you know, 100% against them, I think people will work out something.
Yeah, I kind of agree with that sentiment. Like, I can tie the micro kind of they're not big enough and has a unique enough culture where it develops its own ecosystem. Like, you won't see a strong penetration of number one. They're historically not friendly to Chinese, I guess you could say, right? So you see a big penetration of Chinese brands like you see in Singapore and Malaysia, right? You like all those like drinking brands, beverage brands. Number one, the consumer behavior is just very different. Like culture, coffee, coffee culture is extremely strong in itself already. You get a lot of like fragmentations of like hipster variations of all kinds of different coffee, low coffee to foreign coffee. So you develop their own Vietnamese brands themselves, tied to different behaviors, right? It's just very distinct than what you would see like when you sit in the sphere where we're sitting of Malaysia, or I don't know, in Indonesia, do they get like the spillover from Chinese ones too?
I don't know. I mean, this is something which is happening. I don't know exactly how much this will happen, and of course we'll go down to analyze. I mean, specific industries. We talk to people in specific industries. They tell a lot about that industry and why things move in a certain way, right? So, but there's a chemical company in my hometown, and they had to go to in Indonesia because palm oil is their sort of key ingredient. And if you can knock off the cost of palm oil by a certain percentage, their profitability and their competitiveness increase a lot. That's why they went to Indonesia like more than 10 years ago and started buying land. So for palm plantations. And I mean, different industries would benefit from sort of different kind of environment. So macro and macro factors, and when we talk about in general, I mean, how the economy will benefit. We talk about a few sort of really, really macro issues, but when it comes down to individual industries, it gets nuanced and it gets much more fascinating.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, that's. I mean, if people who want to build or invest in these countries, they have to take that into consideration, right? It's just really. It's a lot. It takes a lot more time and specialization than people think. I found it very interesting because in the hotel we were staying was like a nice 5-star hotel. My sister got it as a gift, and then I met these like Americans who had never been to Vietnam for the first time, and they were diversifying their furniture company based in like Michigan, something like, I forget where they're somewhere in the U.S. And then they instead of opening factories in, you know, expanding factory capacity in Mexico and other countries, or like even like what's common is like Western Europe, they were like looking at Vietnam for the first time. And he was very blurred. It's like, yeah, it's very complex out here. Like he was trying to dig something out of us, but I was just like, I'm on vacation, bro. So, but it was fascinating to see that even in this day and age, like there's just people who are just so out of this, like they have no understanding of this part of this world, which is interesting. And, but what you see that kind of offshoring, like their diversification is happening and it's there, but for a white guy, it might be a little bit challenging for him. We'll have to agree. You need to know the right people because it's a common trope for Vietnam. If you're a foreigner doing business, a lot of times they do get ripped off. So
I think at the end of the day, I mean, the world is still big. I mean, even if you go to like a small country like Cambodia, you see a vibrant ecosystem of people. And amongst tech founders I've seen, of course, some of them run on sort of VC backed businesses, which are difficult because it's a small market, but some of them, I mean, use a bit of tech to transform some traditional businesses, and some of them are doing really well. And I remember this guy was driving a Mercedes Maybach like S680, which I think in Singapore would be retail for millions of dollars. I'm not sure about the price in Cambodia. And he was a graphic designer before he went to Cambodia like 8 years ago, and he built a business purely there. And he was not from a rich family.
Wow.
So there are opportunities everywhere. So. I remember a recent podcast I listened to Lex Friedman with Tucker Carlson. I don't agree with many things Tucker Carlson said, but this one thing which he said which kind of resonates. He said that you should really try to understand Russia and jump on a plane and go to Moscow and go and figure out, talk to the people there, walk around. Yeah,
absolutely true.
That's the first step. And of course, if you want to do business, et cetera, that takes much more attention. That takes much more time. That takes much more mental space. And that's tough, but that's what makes this exploration fascinating.
Yeah. And, you know, if you know, you're looking for the first step, that's why we have a podcast like this too. You know, you could contact us. We're here. We've been to places, you know, you can reach out to us. And then,
we've learned some hard lessons for Southeast Asia.
yes. So, you know, we're here and we're doing this. So, you know, feel free to reach out if you are interested in a really far, far abroad. Any final closing thoughts then? Are you ready for your China trip?
Yeah, it's I think it's fully subscribed. The team is still finalizing the logistics.
Congrats.
but I think it's fully subscribed, and the agenda is full. So we're thinking about. I think we should do a dedicated session after that trip, and then we could talk about what we have seen, what we have observed, and but this is
for sure.
It's exciting. Mm.
Yeah, so maybe sometime next month when you're traveling, we get a short update from China. I'll be in the US, so I'll be trying to do maybe, worst case, some solo quick updates. But if anyone wants to talk to me, we can do quick updates too. So I'll be in the US giving my assessment of what's happening on the ground. Of course, there'll be more from what I'm focused on at the time, which is like CPG. So I'll be talking to a lot of CPG founders, food industry
founders.
What
is CPG for people who don't know about it?
Consumer
packaged goods.
Yes, correct. Okay. So that's, I'm helping my wife's company continue expansion and distribution into America. So then that's kind of where I'll be for majority of work. But I will try to talk to other people too, see what's around happening from West Coast to East Coast primarily. But we'll definitely be in touch. And then, it was a good episode. And then we'll talk sometime soon in the future again.
Yeah, let's do that. Okay, have a good weekend. Bye.
You too.